Families have a lot going on. Let Ollie help manage the mental load with new cognitive health supplements for everyone 4 and up, like delicious Ollie Focus Pops or Ollie Mellow Pops for kids. And for parents, try 3 new Brainy Chews to help you focus, chill out, or get energized. Find these cognitive health buddies for the whole fam at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. Your work can take you all over the place, like Texas. You've never been, but it's going to be great because you're staying at La Quinta by Wyndham. Their free bright side breakfast will give you energy for the day ahead. And after, you can unwind using their free high-speed Wi-Fi. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book your stay today at LQ.com.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to a new episode on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Géraldine Gutfin. Today, I'm thrilled to host Rachel Blumenthal, who is a lawyer and a historian. Rachel is currently a fellow at the Avraham Harman Research Institute of Contemporary Jewry at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem. In today's episode, we'll talk about her recent monograph, Right to Reparations, the Claims Conference and Holocaust Survivors, 1951 to 1964, which was published by Lexington Books in 2021. Rachel, welcome to the show.
Hi.
So as is customary, we usually start by asking our guests to talk a little bit about themselves, about their intellectual interests, and what brought them to the book. So Rachel, who are you, and what led you to writing this book about the Claims Conference?
Okay, so as you said, I am a lawyer. I trained as a lawyer, I work as a lawyer, and I'm also a historian. And I was born, as you can hear, in England, and I moved to Israel in 1981. And I am very interested in the impact of the Holocaust on the lives of people. And this is the focus of my research. And this is why I studied the Claims Conference.
So can you tell the listeners a bit more about the Claims Conference? I think among people who are a bit familiar with the Jewish history or Jewish contemporary life, it's a familiar name. But at least in my experience, it sounded familiar at some level, but I wouldn't have been able to, you know, previous to reading your book, I wouldn't have been able to state exactly why it's important for Jewish history. And it wasn't clear to me what its role was. I understood it has something to do with reparations, but it wasn't exactly clear the scope of their activities after the war. So before we kind of delve deeper into the book, can you kind of give us an introduction to what the organization is?
So the Claims Conference is the spokesman on behalf of Holocaust survivors. It was created in 1951. It negotiated with the German government together with Israel on reparations for Holocaust survivors. It's one of the most powerful organizations in the Jewish world. It's very rich. And it's very unusual in that it both conducts negotiations with governments and distributes funds that are provided by governments to survivors. And it's also very unusual in that it has existed for so long. It's 73 years, and it's still going strong. And so this is what interested me. I think The reason why I was very curious was that at the end of the Second World War, you have lots of survivors from different countries speaking different languages who had different experiences. And as a lawyer, I know that you need someone to put forward your case to a government. And how do you form an entity which represents all the different groups, or does it represent all the different groups of people who were persecuted by Nazi Germany? How did it evolve, and how did it behave? How did it acquire authority both inside inside the Jewish world and vis-a-vis government? So this is what interested me, and this is why I wrote about the Thames Conference.
So let's zoom in on this moment of 1951. Where was it created, and who were the founding members of this organization? And here, I'm especially curious to hear more about Nachum Goldman, who I understand to be one of the central character in the book. So can you kind of unpack a little bit about what exactly happened in 1951?
So what happened was that for 6 years, nothing happened, basically. You have people who lost everything and had to rebuild their lives. They have no compensation, they have no restitution. There's this big void in the advocacy for the right of Jews to receive some form of compensation. There were conferences, and Jews put forward claims to receive compensation, but the states all rejected their claims. And so you have this big void. And what happened was that in 1951, Israel decided that it had no alternative but to negotiate directly with West Germany on reparations. And the Jewish organizations, especially the American Jewish organizations, wanted to participate in negotiations alongside Israel. Israel objected to a second claimant on behalf of World Jewry. And there is this one person, Nachum Goldman, who was a lawyer. He was trained in Germany. He was very, very gifted, and he knew how to talk to politicians. He spoke lots of languages. He knew how to organize the leaders of the Jewish organizations in the world. And he convened a meeting which took place at the Waldorf Astoria in October 1951. And Israel thought that the purpose was to sort of form the organizations into sort of a cheerleader for Israel's claim to reparations. The organizations that attended the meeting had a completely different idea. And the end result was that these organizations that were handpicked by Nachum Goldman, they decided to set up two committees to participate alongside Israel in negotiations with West Germany on reparations.
So what do you understand Nachum Goldman's motivations to have been at the time, in this particular moment, and how might his motivations have evolved, from 1951 to, say 1964, which is the timeline that you're examining in the book?
I think Nachum Goldman was very aware that it was very important both for individual survivors to receive some form of compensation and for there to be an entity outside Israel that had funds. What he believed in was to rebuild the Jewish world. Of course, maybe that's sort of a fantasy, because once something has been destroyed, it's very difficult, if not impossible, to rebuild. But this is what he wanted. He enjoyed forming coalitions. He formed lots of different coalitions. He was very good at it. And he knew how to talk to people. He was very, very gifted.
Can you reflect a little bit on his relationship with Konrad Adenauer? Because I think one of the claims of the book is that the relationship between Goldman and Adenauer was really central to the agreements that were reached between the Claims Conference and West Germany.
I agree. I mean, I agree with my own argument. But, I think at the time, the Israeli politicians found it very difficult to talk to German politicians. There was a huge hostility in Israel to the idea of direct talks. And the Israeli, for instance, the delegation had instructions not to talk German to the German negotiators, although they were all German speakers themselves. And Nahum Goldman didn't have these sort of strange ideas that you couldn't speak German, you couldn't do this. He knew that in order to get an agreement, you had to sort of have a reasonable personal relationship with the person you're negotiating with. And he met Konrad Adenauer, and he understood that Konrad Adenauer had this great interest in reaching agreement. It's very strange, Konrad Adenauer's view, because he had this concept of world Jewry, which is basically an anti-Semitic idea that, you know, all Jews form some part of world Jewry. And Nahum Goldman played along, and he presented himself as a leader of world Jewry. Konrad Adenauer had this belief that if the Jews, world Jewry, reached an agreement with him, it would help Germany, West Germany at the time, because there was no Germany, West Germany regain its status as a world power. Nahum Goldman went to meet Adenauer in his home in Randolph, and he persuaded him to overrule his own politicians, which, if you think about it, is quite amazing, because you have, you know, politicians are always guided by other, you know, their party needs and the needs of their country. And yet Goldman persuaded Adenauer of the importance of reaching an agreement on compensation for Holocaust survivors. And this is clearly indicative of the very strength of the relationship and the powers of persuasion of Nahum Goldman.
So let's step back a little bit and kind of situate the Klimt Conference within this broader conversation that's ongoing in the scholarship about reparations. And actually, it's not just in the scholarship. If you look at the US today, there's a lot of talk, public discussions about compensation for descendants of slaves in the US. So it's a topic, I think, that garners a lot of attention. So can we talk a little bit about the nomenclature and the distinctions between restitution, reparations, compensation? What do you understand those different terms to mean? And also, kind of more generally, how did the idea of reparation come about in the immediate aftermath of the war? We kind of take it for granted today because we're living decades after those reparations were put into place, but it wasn't something that everyone took for granted after the war. So how did this idea emerge?
So first, the different categories of remedies. So you have restitution is if your property has been stolen, which it was by the Nazi state, but it was Aryanized. Restitution is the right to receive back your property, which was not, you know, it was not clearly understood. And lots of countries haven't returned property that was stolen from communities. Compensation is the right to receive some payment for the suffering. Reparations, under international law, the basic concept of reparations was that two states go to war, one state wins, one state loses. The state that wins is entitled to receive from the state that lost compensation for basically for the expense of going to war. So this was the traditional understanding of reparations. And what happened was that during the war, or even before the war, Nazi Germany had this huge project of stealing everything that belonged to Jews. And a lot of the Jewish lawyers sort of had thought or considered how legal justifications for recovering property that had been stolen and later on for compensation. The basis of the claim was always property. I mean, now it seems to us very strange that the property and not the suffering and the death, the murder and the injuries to bodies, bodily damages were the basis of the claims. But at the time, under the law, legal understanding of the time, what was important was property. And so the earliest claims were based on Jewish property that had been stolen and claims for restitution. And so When the Claims Conference negotiated with West Germany in the 1950s and 1952, they based their claim on property that had been stolen and that hadn't been returned. Because neither Israel nor the Claims Conference had been states that had gone to war with West Germany. So Israel based its claim on the cost of absorption of the Holocaust survivors who settled in Israel, and the claim based its claim on the cost of the property that had been stolen that hadn't been restored.
So that's something I want to explore more into details. The fact that Israel on the one hand and the Claims Conference on the other hand, which was made up of diaspora groups, especially American Jews, conducted separate negotiations with West Germany. Can you unpack this a little bit, explain why they couldn't agree on negotiations and why they parted ways in some ways? And maybe one way to answer the question is to look more closely at the legal framework that came out of those negotiations. So the important laws and agreements that you describe in the book are the Luxembourg Agreement of 1952, Protocols 1 and 2, and the Federal Indemnification Law of 1953. So could you tell the listeners a bit more about what these agreements and laws were about exactly?
Okay, so Israel was at a critical stage of its existence. It had been created 4 years earlier. There had been this huge influx of destitute migrants, olim, and Israel desperately needed foreign currency. It didn't have money to feed people or to provide housing. People lived in huts, in tents for years. So Israel, its view was that it would take money. Eventually, it wasn't even money. It was goods from West Germany to build its economy. And they viewed reparations as a communal compensation to compensate the community and not the individuals. The Claims Conference had this very different vision. So Israel signed the Luxembourg Agreement, which said that it would receive it would receive $750 million in goods over a period of originally 14 years, and then it was 11 years, and they received a sort of infrastructure goods, and it did help rebuild the economy. The Claims Conference had this completely different vision of what reparations should be. So the Claims Conference wanted compensation for individuals. At the time, they focused on people who had lived in Germany. We forget now that there was this Iron Curtain. So at the time, a lot of people lived behind the Iron Curtain, and it was clear that they wouldn't receive any compensation from West Germany. And so the Claims Conference wanted compensation for individual survivors not outside the Iron Curtain. And They reached an agreement with West Germany that West Germany would pay compensation to anyone connected to German culture. It's sort of a slightly ironic idea, German culture, because German culture had perpetrated the Holocaust. But in order to receive compensation, you had to prove that you knew Goethe and Schiller and you could understand Rilke. And this was Protocol 1 set down the principles, which it later formed the basis of the German law, the Bundesentschädigungsgesetz, which provided compensation not only for Jews, but for any victim of the Third Reich. And this was, first, it was revolutionary, and second, it benefited a huge group of people, but at the same time, it left out maybe the majority of the Jewish survivors, because they were either in Eastern Europe, or they had no connection to the German culture. And so this was the first protocol, which was, as I say, a huge achievement. The second protocol was about giving compensation to the Claims Conference to allocate to survivors. And the Germans and the Claims Conference had very different ideas about the how this money should be used. The Germans wanted the money to go to those survivors who were not entitled directly to compensation from Germany. The Claimants Conference wanted to use the money in a completely different way. And what I find very surprising, was how counterintuitive the guidelines prescribed by the Claimants Conference were. So if I was the sort of, I had a lot of money and you have these people who are destitute, you know, you think you give the money to the people who are destitute, but they didn't think of it that way. So they laid down these guidelines, which were, first of all, the Americans, not Europeans, would decide. And secondly, the money wouldn't go to individuals, it would go to institutions. And thirdly, it would go to for long-term needs and not for short-term needs. And finally, you have an exclusion, which is that, of course, it doesn't go to individuals, but it does go to one group of people, rabbis and communal leaders. And by chance, they're very similar to the people who are deciding on how to allocate the funds. And so these guidelines, which, you know, are clearly meet an organizational need and enable the continued existence of the organization, but not as how I would see, you know, the best way of helping people to rebuild their lives after the Holocaust. But then clearly that's why an academic, that's why I'm an academic and not a leader of an organization.
So let's talk about this more. I'm especially curious to hear more about the kind of institutions that directly benefited from the Claims Conference Fund, or the funds that the Claims Conference was able to get from the West German government. And also, when you mentioned the long-term needs, what did they understand to be the long-term needs of Jewish communities in the plural? In other words, where did they allocate the money exactly? Where and how?
So there are lots of different ways, and I think the main beneficiary of the funds was an organization called the Joint Distribution Committee, which is an American organization that was established in 1914, funded displaced persons after the Second World War. It had helped them readjust, resettle, and rebuild their lives. And in the 1950s, it had run out of funds, basically. And the Claims Conference decided that the joint would receive the largest section of funds. And how the joint has this view of the world, that what you do is you don't give people money to, you don't trust people, basically. So you know better than the people how they should spend the money. So you create institutions, you build a Jewish community center. A lot of the money went to yeshivot, to mikvaot, and you give money for training, as funds for loans. But people, of course, have to repay the loans, and these are not sort of day-to-day money to go to buy yourself bread and milk. And this is how they saw the best use of the money would be.
So that's something I find especially interesting in your book, because I was familiar with the work of the JDC after the war. And recently, actually, in the podcast, I interviewed Laura Hobson-Farr, who wrote this book titled The Jewish Marshall Plan, about the role that the JDC played in Europe, especially in France, in the reconstruction of Jewish communities there. And that piece of information, I wasn't really aware of until I read your book, that the funding that JDC had in its pockets actually came from the Claims Conference. And so I think unearthing this, the ways in which you really show the ways in which the money was allocated and certain Jewish institutions benefited way more than others. I thought that was really one of the strengths of your book.
Thank you. I think what I noticed was how paternalistic the both the Claims Conference and the Joint was. So they both thought, you know, that they understood better than the people who had survived how they should spend the funds. These community centres, a lot of them no longer exist. Some of them do. Anyone who's been into buildings, you know, Jewish institutions, wherever, you always see these huge plaques. And Frank Kishon has a story about it, that the plaque is more important. But, you know, I don't know whether this was really the best way that you could help survivors rebuild their lives. It's open to debate. I think there is no simple answer to the best way to spend welfare funds, and states have this problem, the same problem.
Of course.
It's complicated.
So did anyone push back against this at the time, individual Jews or organizations, Jewish organizations, perhaps applied to be part of the Krems Conference, but whose applications were rejected? Did people voice criticism of these policies? Or because, as you say in the book, the institution is quite opaque, individual Jews might not have realized the ways in which the money was used at the time.
So at the time, I think no one understood how it worked. I don't think anyone understood the system. And I think to this day, the Claims Conference is still a very opaque organization. There was criticism in the press. There is criticism in the press. The Claims Conference now publishes financial statements, and it's much more open, but it's still basically the decisions they make behind closed doors. For instance, there was opposition from Agudat Israel, which is this ultra-Orthodox organization, against the idea that no individual would get compensation, which is why they worked out this solution that rabbis and community leaders would receive personal funds. I think it's important to remember that most of the members of the Claims Conference were not welfare organizations. They were advocacy groups. They didn't have much experience in how to allocate funds. The leaders, of course, themselves were sort of rich, well-off people, and they didn't know poverty. And so it was very easy for them to decide or to adopt the policy, which was well defined by the joint, that they knew how to spend it and they'd had lots of experience. And I think this is why it worked. The Claims Conference didn't let the press into its meetings. It didn't discuss things in the open. There was no appeals process. I found cases in America where people went to American courts against the Claims Conference, and they were always kicked out on the grounds that the Claims Conference had absolute authority to decide by itself how to spend funds.
That's fascinating. So one thing that really, well, two things that shocked me in the book that I think are worse, I think you alluded to this, but it's worth really stating it very, very explicitly and clearly, is one, the fact that Holocaust survivors from places like Austria and Eastern Europe did not qualify for compensation. So when we think about Holocaust victims, I mean, obviously, East European Jews often come kind of at the forefront of our minds. So the fact that they were actually not qualified to apply to this compensation is quite shocking. And the other thing, as you show in the book, is that organizations of Holocaust survivors were not admitted into the Claims Conference until 1989. So we're talking, you know, half a century after the funding of the Claims Conference. So this is very counterintuitive, because again, people were not familiar with the Claims Conference. I think the logic thing to assume is that East European Jews obviously benefited from these agreements, and that Holocaust survivors were part of negotiating the agreements and also deciding where the money would go. And in fact, this was not the case at all.
I think it's important to remember that there was at the time an Iron Curtain, and the idea that West Germany would give money to people behind the Iron Curtain was not really possible. But there were groups of East European survivors in England, in America, who applied to join the Claims Conference, who applied for funds, and they never received. So you're right, it is counterintuitive. It's very sad. And there were two groups of survivors that were represented in the Claims Conference from the beginning. They were the Jews in Germany The Jews from Germany who'd left Germany. This was a council that was set up by Leo Beck. And there was a Zentralrat, which was a group of Jews in Germany. These were DPs who'd stayed in Germany after the war. So they represented the interests of survivors. But as we know, this was a very small group of the entire European Jewry. I think you're right. It is strange. I mean, this should have been an organization of survivors. And even today, the survivor organizations, they're 4 of 27 or something. They're a minority. I think it's one of the reasons why the Claims Conference is so successful, because they're always a minority. But it's problematic.
So one way that you frame it in the book is you talk about the Claims Conference perpetuating medieval forms of self-governance. So I think that's maybe one way to frame this question of how the funds were allocated. We don't have time to discuss this in great detail, but for anyone who's interested, I really invite them to read your book for more details on how the executive members of the organization were making those decisions. One thing I wanted to ask you was about sources and archives, because as we said, this was an opaque institution. So how do you go about, you know, unearthing this complicated history when the institution doesn't really want to bring attention to how it's making this kind of decision? So how did you go about it? And how did you find the sources that were relevant for the book?
So the Claims Conference has lots of archives, and they did something, again, I never understood why, but they shipped this. A Claims Conference is in New York, but they shipped their archives for the long decade of 1951 to 1964 to Israel. And they were sort of in boxes somewhere, and no one sort of had access to them unless you were contacted by the Claims Conference to write their history. And I applied for permission to review the documents, and I applied and I heard nothing, and I applied again and I heard nothing. And it took months until they allowed me to receive access to the documents. At the time, the documents were in the Central Archives of the History of Jewish People, which was in a sort of small asbestos hut on Givat Ram. And I went there and I was surrounded by all these very noisy people. But the files are fascinating. I used also archives from the Israeli Foreign Ministry and archives of the Joint. The Joint has this brilliant digitized archive, and of other members. I want to say something else, which is that what was important to me was to place the claims in the context of this post-war belief of forming international organizations to promote. There was this great sort of consensus in the world that the way to prevent a third world war was through institutions. And the Claims Conference was clearly impacted by this belief. I think it's one of the reasons why it acquired so much authority. And there is literature on this, and I use this sort of benchmark, understanding how the Claims Conference was created, functioned. So this was very important for my study.
So two questions before we end the discussion. The first one is, so the claims still exist. So what is the Claims Conference up to today? And the second question, kind of stepping away from the Jewish case, is, so these agreements that were reached between West Germany and the Claims Conference, what was the legacy of these agreements beyond the Jewish community? Did any other communities, other parties in other contexts turn to these agreements to make a legal case for reparations?
Wait, so the first question was?
The first question has to do with the Claims Conference today.
So the Claims Conference is, of course, still going strong. I looked in its financial statements. It has $500 million. But the Claims Conference has decided, again, this is counterintuitive, that instead of spending the money on the few remaining survivors, who a lot of them are destitute and ill and in need of funds for medical treatment or whatever, they do fund this, but on a very sort of, on a certain level. But instead of taking the remaining funds and dividing it up between the remaining survivors, what they've decided to do is to invest the money in Holocaust education. I'm not a great fan of Holocaust education, so that's what they do. And as to the legacy, yes, it had a huge legacy, at least for Holocaust survivors, in the sense that over the years, larger and larger groups did receive some form of compensation, especially after the reunification of Germany in 1989. So after 1989, you have what they call the Article 2 of the reunification agreement, where Germany set up a fund for all the people who had never received any funds directly from Germany in the past. And they pay out monthly payments to people in Eastern Europe, in Western Europe, in America. And I mean, when you think about the suffering that people went through, they're not huge sums, but they're definitely better than nothing. And I think it has a huge impact throughout the world on how you see reparations and the justification for compensation.
Thank you, Rachel. So one last thing that I wanted to ask, which is also customary, is what have you been up to since publishing the book? What projects are you currently working on? And are you still interested in writing organizational history? Which is, you know, some, we've talked about this in the past in private about how surprisingly interesting organizational history can be. So is this something you're still engaging with in your current projects, current and future research projects?
So after I wrote the book, I started researching Jewish, what they call DPs, displaced persons, refugees, basically refugees in Austria. And there's not been very much written about the lives of the DPs. There were 220,000 people left Eastern Europe, and they wanted to get to, they wanted to leave Europe, and they ended up being stuck in Austria. And the organization that ran their lives, that assisted them, was UNRWA. UNRWA in Israel at the moment is a very problematic term, but it was a different organization. It's UNRRA, United Nations Relief and Rehabilitation Administration. So I reviewed that. I reviewed their archives. Again, it's fascinating the way that organizational logic doesn't always meet sort of simple logic. And so I've done research on that. And now I'm researching the way that Austria dealt with former Austrian, mainly Jews. Did they give them, did they provide restitution? Did they provide compensation? And the Claims Conference, again, was involved in the campaign for some sort of remedy, but with much, much less success, which is why no one has ever heard about it. And so this is my latest project.
Good luck with this. Rachel, it's been such a pleasure to host you today. And thank you to our listeners for joining us. Our pleasure. And thank you all for listening. Have a great day.
Thank you.